Start this tax committee meeting, and we do not have a quorum yet. I think we're a couple members short yet. But we will start to hear the first bill, which is House File 3143. Representative Winkler, welcome to the tax committee. And we can't move your bill right now, but we can hear it. And when we get enough members for a quorum, we then can move that bill. So, Representative, if you would please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have three bills today, so hopefully you'll have a chance to take positive action on all three of them before the chair arrives.
Representative Winkler, for the benefit of the committee, would you prioritize them in the order of how important
I think
they are? Which order you'd like us to consider them when we look at the
My three bills are first on the agenda, Mr. Chair, and
yes.
So I think that is a priority.
Yeah, all right.
I think we're starting, though, with 3143 on the agenda, which is my intent anyway. Mr. Chair, the three bills that I'm presenting today are reflective of a situation that I think Minnesota needs to take very seriously. And it's something that we haven't dealt with in some time. And there's a lot of course, other noise and things that happen during a legislative session that can distract us from the long-term view. But for the first time in a generation, Minnesota's economy is actually slipping behind the rest of the country. There's a lot of talk, of course, about the overall state of the nation's economy and a recession and whether we're there yet or just on our way. But the truly disturbing thing that Minnesotans should worry about and this committee and this legislature should worry about is that we're actually underperforming the nation. And so I took the somewhat logical approach, I guess, of asking the state economist or trying to find out what the state economist thinks is the reason for that. And I have an article here from Min Post, and one quote that Dr. Stinson has been attributed to him is that the identification of new products and new processes and new ways of doing things has slumped significantly in Minnesota compared to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. And his supposition is that that is because we are not investing in new technology and early stage technology companies the way we once did. In general, capital flows to good ideas and good people. But in Minnesota, that capital has not been flowing to early stage companies. And there are a number of reasons for that. Overall, the venture capital sector of the capital market has shifted to later stage companies. So they're looking for deals that may be $5 million or larger. And that money is not looking for deals that are $500,000 to $5 million. That early stage money is really the crucial phase and the kind of the pinch in the hose of the pipeline of new technology and new companies growing up in this state. So the three bills that I have today attempt to open up that hose and get more capital flowing to that early segment of the market. I should note that in addition to capital flowing to those early companies, academic R&D spending in Minnesota has dropped significantly from where it was in the early 1970s, from the top quartile of the nation down to 43rd, I think. And so the bonding bill that we just passed and was signed with the U of M biomedical facilities is a crucial component of this as well. If you add the new research space and the kind of researchers that can attract, together with some other incentives that we can put in place, we can begin to address this issue of new technology and new technology companies starting to open up a pipeline in Minnesota and lead to the kind of growth that we've come to expect over time. So House File 3143 is an investment tax credit for angel investors. It is up to $25,000 or 25% of the investment that the angel investor makes in the new company. So if an angel, and they have to be an accredited investor. So that means they have to either have high income or high net worth under the SEC rules. That basically means that they are somebody who is a sophisticated investor and can afford to lose this highly risky money. The credit takes some of that risk away from them and encourages them to put money into Minnesota companies. And so they may put in $100,000. Five people put in $100,000. They can claim the credit of $25,000 and have $500,000 of startup money for a company to get beyond the kind of friends and family stage of investment and move things along. And there are criteria in the bill for the types of companies that qualify, but in this bill, it is focused on high technology or high tech companies. They have to be certified by deed to that they meet the definition. Their headquarters has to be in Minnesota. 51% of their employees have to be in Minnesota. They have to have fewer than 25 employees and less than $1 million in gross sales and total private investment of less than $2 million. So we're really, the bill really focuses resources on the very earliest kind of critical stage of companies. And it's a phase that the, you know, is often referred to as the valley of death. When there's a good idea or a new technology spun out and maybe a patent has been developed and they have launched the company and they're out there looking for markets and they're starting to hire employees, but getting from that phase of starting it on your own to the phase of, you know, a $5 million deal where a venture capital company might be interested in coming in and putting money into your venture is the crucial phase, and this really tries to target tax credit to encourage people to invest there. And there's, you know, there's more detail here. I don't know how much that detail you want to hear, but that's the essence of 3143.
Thank you very much, Representative Winkler. At this time, the Tax Committee is very pleased to have a good group, a large group of students from Albert Lee High School. Welcome very much to the Tax Committee, and hopefully you'll learn a little bit about tax policy. Representative Brown would be very proud to have you here, I'm sure, today. So are you here all day or just part of the day?
We're here all day.
Oh, very good. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
So, you hear lots about tax credits and moving us into the 21st century with technology and so forth. So, Representative Winkler, do you have any testifiers? On this bill?
Mr. Chair, there was a scheduling confusion, I guess. I don't have a testifier on this bill at this time.
Okay,
but the testifier would have talked about his experience as a CEO of a startup company and the difficulty in finding seed money in Minnesota to get going and the kinds of incentives that are available, for example, in Wisconsin, which has this exact angel investment credit program. And the ability to, in the same way with Ohio, that so long as you're willing to move your company to Wisconsin or Ohio, you can get the kind of early stage money to build your company. And Minnesota doesn't really have anything in the, you know, anything to offer in that regard. So that was essentially what he was going to talk about.
Before I open it up to anyone from the audience for or against, Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I like where you're trying to go with this, and I like your comments and your opening comments about Dr. Simpson and where we need to be going. It seems that there's a lot of discussion going a different direction in this committee lately, so I'm glad to see the openness here. My question to you is, with these limited dollars that they have to work with, are we going to be pitting one set of businesses against another by taking this amount of dollars out of deed for this project?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, originally that was the concept of the bill, and that because of our process around here, it's not really quite that easy just to take money out of an agency in one division and fund a tax credit in another. So I think that section of the bill was actually has been removed. Now, my personal view is that we're far better off concentrating our resources in a tax credit that has been shown to change investment behavior in other places rather than funding a state agency that provides services or may do other things. But yeah, I think we're better off with a tax credit rather than funding deed. But that's not just how we're set up to be able to do things around here. And so I don't think there is that trade-off. Ultimately, this comes down to, I think, you know, this has to come out of the tax committee target one way or another.
Thank you.
Representative Deal Forrest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Good morning. Representative Winkler, welcome to the Tax Committee. I think it's your maiden voyage.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deal Forrest, it is a maiden voyage, although that kind of brings up thoughts of the Titanic, I guess.
No, Representative Winkler, Mr. Chair, in reality, it brings up the fact that you didn't bring me treats.
That's
fine with it.
Correct?
All right, Representative Powell back then. Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, on a serious note, you had mentioned earlier about apparently capital flowing more to the late-stage companies than early-stage startups. And, you know, I start from the proposition of a theory of an efficient allocation of resources within the markets. And so my question basically is, what do we in the legislature and in the tax committee know that the market doesn't know with respect to allocating the resources within the sector of the economy?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest, different, it's not, there are certain barriers, I guess I would say, in places like Silicon Valley or in the Boston with the medical establishments they have, that there is enough new entrepreneurs who come up through this kind of highly entrepreneurial, high, you know, risk-taking environment. They have money, they tend to put it back in the kinds of businesses that they have come up with, and a lot of that early-stage money sits in the coast. They don't have information or access to information about these relatively small deals that are going on in Minnesota. So to the extent Minnesota has this kind of, our strongest segment in this market anyway is in medical devices because we have a reputation. So what we know is that there are good deals to be had. It's just that there are, it's not necessarily the best or the easiest thing to do to come from California, fly to Minnesota and look for a $500,000 deal, even though they might be good ones there. Getting past the information barrier and getting to the state is part of the thing that is different, I guess. So something that we know in Minnesota that other places don't, people don't know in the capital markets and the coast, is that we have good deals here. And we'll hear more about that in the third bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I just had one follow-up question. I hate being on the other side of the issue from Representative Simpson so much these days. But Representative Winkler, as Representative Simpson likes to say, that we're not all pure on all the issues, and so I'm not necessarily opposed to credits and the like to encourage investment where the market may not be leading the capital. But the final question I have to follow up is, what kind of empirical data do we have to show that encouraging the market to reallocate resources based on government interference, which is what you're doing by providing the credit, do we have any empirical data to show that the odds are high that will bear fruit for the state and for government, for the private sector, et cetera, et cetera?
Representative Link.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest, peer-reviewed research studies on an angel investment tax credit aren't available right now simply because it's a relatively new approach. I will say that in Wisconsin, since they initiated this in 2005, investment by angel investors in early-stage companies has grown by about 50%. So this actually does, at least from the perspective of changing behavior, the angel investment tax credit does change the investment behavior and move more money into this segment. Now, from a broader point of view, is that returning an overall public good? It is a good return on the investment for those particular dollars. There aren't the studies to demonstrate that. It's relatively new. I guess my suggestion would be that if that's the standard that we use at the legislature, we would definitely have to be here full time to have to make that kind of decision on every spending bill that we have.
Thank you. We do have a quorum now, so Representative Tilbury moves House File 3143 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. You made the quorum, Representative Dill. Now, is there anyone who would like to testify for or against House File 3143 at this time? Please come forward and please state your name.
Good morning, members.
Good morning.
My name is Peter Lindstrom, and I am the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota High-Tech Association. MHTA is a member association, nonprofit trade association, with about 350 high-tech companies here in Minnesota. And we are here in support of Representative Winkler's legislation this morning. Let me just give you a real broad overview of high-tech in Minnesota. We have 128,000 high-tech employees in the state. And by the way, those employees provide a payroll of about $9 billion. 128,000 employees, but a report that came out just last week showed that those job increases are really flat for this past year. We're not creating jobs at the same extent in our high-tech field as other states. And I was looking at Representative Brinkley's legislation, and it is a surgical strike to the jobs which are going to be created in the future. We're looking at alternative energy, aerospace, biotech, environmental engineering, food technology, ethanol, information technology, green manufacturing, nanotech. These are the fields which are going to be growing. These are the fields that the students here at Albert Lea, we hope, are going to be going into those fields. These are the jobs of the 21st century. So I think we ought to have every tool in the toolbox to help these companies grow, and we believe a big part of that is these credits and other legislation which Representative Winkler is proposing this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Winkler.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else care to testify for or against?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandig. I'm here on behalf of Life Science Alley. We represent over 500 companies in medical device, bioscience, the whole spectrum as far as healthcare. We are here in support of Representative Winkler's bill. We're very supportive. Basically, what we hear from a lot of our entrepreneurs who one was supposed to be here today and thought that the hearing was tomorrow, so I apologize for that. But the number one issue that we hear from our small entrepreneurs and startup companies is this kind of seed money that we're looking at. Basically, when they look at getting into business, they use family, friends, any kind of money they have, and they get to a certain part. And what they will tell you for those, and a lot of these entrepreneurs do a number of different companies and things like that, that finding the $250,000 is as tough as finding the $10 million in looking at it. Because if you're looking at the bioscience, many of these are very risky. Some of these businesses will take off, some will not. Obviously, with angel investors, they'll still have to do their diligence in looking at these, but this is an incentive. And we've also found in Minnesota that we're not doing as much as far as startup companies. Obviously, we have the very mature industries with the Medtronics, the St. Jude's, but if we're looking out into the future, we're going to have to see the convergence. It will no longer be just medical device. It will be convergence of pharma. And a lot of the ways that the mature industries are also going to stay here and to grow is looking at what they do with some of these small companies and what they're able to do. What we've also heard with the entrepreneurs is where they're able to get this money, because by the time they go for the second level of funding, they've invested a lot of time and effort. And so they're going to go where their company can get that money. The gentleman that would have been here today was very closely looking at Wisconsin to get the angel funds that were in Wisconsin. He just had to move to Hudson, but he would still have to be in Wisconsin to do that, and was prepared to do that. Another one of ours was looking at Ohio, and many of these people are lifelong Minnesotans that want to stay in Minnesota but to pursue their dream. So we think this is a really important bill. When we're looking at the investments that the legislature put in the university as far as the new facilities and the research and things like that, we need to grow that research into jobs. And we see that Minnesota is lacking in that, and hope that you'll look at this as a relatively modest investment and a lot of other things as far as starting up with some of those companies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else care to testify for or against? If not, Representative Winkler, any last comments on House File 3143?
Mr. Chair, members, no last comments here. I guess I would say that this is a bill that's very similar to one that Representative Dabney carried last session, and it's, I think, something that I will keep coming back and coming back and coming back. And something, part of a package of things I think we need to do to kind of jumpstart this part of our economy.
Thank you very much. Representative Tilbury renews his motion on 3143 to lay over that bill for possible inclusion into the tax bill. We're going to move now to House File 3144. Representative Coonan moves 3144 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 3144 has a slightly different approach. This one, over the fall and winter, I spent some time meeting with venture capitalists and angel investors in this sector and asking them for ideas, things that would make a difference for getting more money flowing to the state for these early stage companies. And one of the ideas resulted in this bill. It's targeted at people who probably either made their fortune or inherited their fortune in Minnesota but now live in Florida or Arizona or Texas or one of those places where their income tax burden isn't quite what it is in Minnesota. And they're advised by their tax accountants that they should not invest in Minnesota companies because that will create an excess of taxation in Minnesota, which is what they are trying to avoid. So what the bill does is define a set of early stage companies, which these presumably high net worth individuals could invest in Minnesota without creating an excess of taxation in the state. And again, the idea is these people would like to and have a special tie to Minnesota. They would like to invest here, but they are concerned about doing so for tax reasons. So this simply says you have a clear statement in Minnesota law that you will not be subject to our taxes as a result of that investment.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Winkler on this? If not, anyone in the audience? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, are other states doing similar kinds of things to protect investment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, not that I'm aware of. I don't. It could be, but this idea came from one particular venture capitalist, and who, whether it's, and I think it would tend to be only in states with relatively high income tax rates and cold weather, because those are the two things that seem to drive people south. So, I think there'd be, not as many states that would be in this situation as Minnesota. I don't know if anybody else is doing it.
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Michael may have some information about if any other states are doing this kind of thing.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, I am not aware of any other state that has a provision that's similar to this. The one thing that the committee ought to keep in mind or be aware of is that this will be an incentive only for investors who are located in states that have lower or no income, lower income taxes than Minnesota or no income tax. Because in general states, not in general, all states with individual income taxes have credits for taxes paid to another state. So just to take an example, for example, if you had a California investor investing in Minnesota as compared with a Florida investor, which is Representative Winkler's example, the California investor who invests in the Minnesota partnership would be liable to pay Minnesota tax, but California, of course, has a higher individual income tax than us. And so California would allow that investor a credit for taxes paid to Minnesota against their California tax. And so that investor is sort of, it doesn't matter to the investor whether or not Minnesota imposes the tax or not, except for the nuisance of filing the Minnesota return and then claiming the California credit. And in fact, what the bill would do in that instance is transfer money from the Minnesota Treasury to the California Treasury. By contrast, the Florida investor, if it subjects that Florida investor to Minnesota tax, would actually have a Minnesota liability, and therefore the credit would operate. So this really sort of operates mainly on investors in low and no tax states, and it doesn't work to encourage investment from somebody located in New York or California, etc.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler.
That is exactly the point of the bill, is to get to those Minnesota expatriates who tend to concentrate in places like Naples, Florida.
Is there anyone in the audience who would care to testify for or against House File 3144? If not, then last closing. Representative DeLaforte?
Well, yeah, Representative Winkler, speak in favor of this bill, because it seems to me now that what you're doing is removing another governmental imposed distortion in the market. I mean, theoretically, it shouldn't matter whether you live in California or Florida if you want to invest in Minnesota. So it seems to me that the policy underlying your bill is to certainly level the playing field, so to speak, because under current law, it seems to me, what you're saying is if you live in a particular jurisdiction, government may discourage you from making an investment you otherwise might make absent your bill.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, I agree. I'm not sure I entirely agree with your economic doctrine across the board, but I think that your principle is correct here.
Very good. Representative Conan will renew his motion to lay over House File 3144 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill. Representative Wolfsberger, would you take the chair at this point?
Thank you. Busy day here, Representative Winkler. Representative Dill, would you like to move Winkler's House File
3538? I would, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So move.
Madam Chair, members, House File 3538 is a much, I would say, bigger endeavor in this area. It is not focused solely on high-tech companies, but it is focused on startup companies, regardless, not entirely regardless, but with a much broader field. This is a program that has been used in other states with great success. I will have a couple of testifiers, but the same economic concerns for Minnesota that that I think support the previous two bills also support this bill. And this is a very innovative approach. Basically, what the bill does is create a tax incentive for health insurance companies, which are required to have large reserves. It gives them a tax credit on their premium taxes starting in 2013, and in exchange for the tax credit, they create an investment pool for startup businesses in Minnesota. And venture capital firms come to Minnesota, they pitch their fund to the insurance companies, and they then compete to take the capital pool that's created from this tax credit. They compete to invest it in qualifying Minnesota companies. They have to have deadlines by which they get all the money into the market in the state, and that money all has to be out before the tax credits start to roll in. So what you're actually doing is putting more capital into early stage Minnesota companies right away by creating this tax credit, which doesn't kick in until 2013. And I'll have two testifiers come up and talk about their experience.
We have had an amendment passed out, the A2 amendment. Is that your amendment?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. I'd rather that amendment not be offered at this time. It's sort of technical in nature, and all the details have not been worked out as yet. It's drafted, and I know it was distributed in your package, but it's not quite ready to be offered, I don't think.
Oh, all right. I'm trying to assist you, so.
I appreciate the effort, Madam Chair.
All right, proceed.
So first I would like to, I think, call up Michael Korngold, and he will talk a little bit about the market need and address, I think, some of, again, Representative De La Forest's questions about what we in state government in Minnesota know that high-tech investors in the coast who fly over Minnesota don't know. It has something to do with us being here, I guess.
Mr. Korngold, for the record, state your name and title.
Michael Korngold. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm the president of Enhanced Capital Partners. We've participated in this program 12 times around the country. I'm actually born and raised in St. Louis Park, and I've told a number of people over the years as we participated in this program elsewhere that this is a program that should have been adopted here, I believe, long ago, because Minnesota has all of the right ingredients, including, unfortunately, some negative ingredients. There's always been a great history here of the business community, the entrepreneurial community, and there's actually a good history here of the venture capital community stepping in to fill a void, certainly banks as well. Unfortunately, the trend lines have been that the venture capital firms that were here and always played in Minnesota at a very small level have gotten very big, and they're not Minnesota-focused at all. In fact, they're like most venture capital money, they're focused on the coast. And the banks have gotten also large, and banks have retrenched in general. And so that valley of death that was alluded to earlier has become even more accentuated. Unfortunately, The trend lines are that Minnesota is, as was mentioned before, falling behind the national averages in terms of capital raised, capital infused into businesses. And the result of that is that the gap is only widening. So what this program has done so successfully in other states is it's filled that gap that exists frequently, again, when a company has something already going that needs capital to grow to get to the point of where a bank will talk to them, or, frankly, they're big enough that they can entice a venture capital firm from one of the coasts or Chicago to take a look. The problem is that if you're a company and you're in Bemidji or you're in Brainerd and you need $700,000 and you're not bankable, you have nowhere to go. You'll never be able to bring somebody in to take a look at that company. And going back to the market efficiency point, because we all believe in efficient markets, the problem with the flow of capital is that capital won't come to seek out that $700,000 opportunity, because it's much more efficient for a fund to find a $5 million opportunity and to find that closer to home. So the last thing I would say, by way of introductory comments, and then we'd be happy to take any questions, is that the reason that states have adopted this program and then come back time and time again to reauthorize it is because, unlike most tax credits or most tax incentives, this program finds a way to tap into capital that absolutely, but for this program, would never be invested in small businesses in Minnesota. These are insurance companies that are sitting on vast pools of capital, some of which are based in Minnesota and have invested with my firm in states around the country. But they've only done so because this program exists, and they will do so here as well. But for this type of program and this type of incentive, that is capital that won't go here. I think that's a key distinction from oftentimes other credits where there's a debate as to how much behavior really is being changed and incentivized. And then the other reason, which is really the main one, is that in this case, the tax credit is not immediate, as was mentioned. This is an incremental tax credit over 4 years, beginning in 2013, and 20% per year for those 4 years. And yet all of the capital that this program raises is available day one and starts being invested day one. And so the reason that other states have reauthorized it is because they've seen the enhanced revenue and economic development benefits accrue before they've ever had to pay in the way of a budgetary impact in the form of a tax credit.
Thank you for that. Representative Winkler, would you like all of your individuals to testify first before we take questions, or do you want it as individuals come up?
Well, Madam Chair, that's, I guess, up to you. I'm sure he'd be happy to take questions. Now, I'd just like to add two quick things to his testimony. In New York, I can't remember how many times, they've reauthorized this five times. And in New York, they have this program set up so that the investment cannot occur in the five borough area of New York City, but it has to be all upstate. So again, it's kind of a similar situation to Minnesota, where you know that money can flow to, you know, New York or Boston or California, but how do you get it to places like Minnesota, which in some ways is like upstate New York? Well, they have seen a $265 million investment as a result of this program directly, which has leveraged other private money at a 5-to-1 ratio. So they've actually, as a result of this program, seen a $1.3 billion investment in startup companies in upstate New York as a result of this. So it has tremendous impact. And one other thing I think to understand is that by putting the money out into these startup companies right away, the early stage companies, what they're doing with that money is hiring people. So not only are you putting that money out in the market right away, you're hiring people and creating jobs immediately. Now, many of those companies may fail. That's just the nature of this type of business. But by putting the money into these companies, they're hiring people, getting people on the payroll, they're paying income tax and all those things. And actually, they have a chart showing that this is never a net negative in revenue for the state of Minnesota because of the amount of income tax generated by these people working in these jobs up until the time that the tax credit has to be paid. So those are two additional points.
Thank you. Any questions for members? Representative Vitalforce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, question for the witness, Mr. Korngold. Mr. Korngold, You had mentioned earlier that sometimes it's difficult for capital to seek out some of the small-scale, early-stage startups because of efficiency considerations. It also seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that also there's a risk premium that's also built into early-stage startups that may not be, there may be a lower premium, of course, with a company with a track record. So it seems one of the advantages here of offering a credit for investors is also to provide an incentive that reduces the risk premium and may encourage an investment, which seems to me is somewhat akin to the public policy, the bankruptcy code, where we want to encourage some risk-taking without being reckless. And I'm just wondering, am I on the right track in considering that component as well as this bill, that we're also trying to reduce the risk premium and encourage more capital to seek out what is by nature a somewhat riskier investment just because it's a new venture?
Thank you. I would agree with that, and I hadn't thought about the bankruptcy code analogy, but yes, I think the incentives are exactly aligned.
Thank you. Any other member? All right, Representative Winkler, would you like to bring up your next testifier?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
For the record, state your name.
Jeff Craver, I'm a Vice President with Advantage Capital Partners.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that these two gentlemen are competitors, but both support this program because of the opportunity that it provides their venture capital firm.
Representative Winkler,
they may not say that, but I will.
And I believe the sponsor and the previous witness have done a very good job of laying this out. And I would just add a couple of details with regard to the proven track record that's been demonstrated in other states. Just briefly going through, 10 states have authorized this program. Picking a couple of the highlights, as mentioned before, New York has gone through it 5 times. Texas, which interestingly enough, is third in the country in attracting traditional venture capital, has also reauthorized this program twice, authorized it 2 times to a total of $400 million. I think that speaks to the value of the way the incentive is targeted to the smaller investments, to the helping bridge the valley of debt. In your packet, there is some information, doesn't have all the notes that mine might have on the bottom, but some information with some charts and graphs with regard to the not only the recent downtrend in early stage investing, but also the breakdown nationwide with regard to the stages of capital investment, which I think is fairly interesting. As you take moments after this hearing to look into this, you'll see that the latest trend has been to move to later and later stages of capital, and I think that's one of the things that Texas is recognizing and still creating this fund to drive the additional pool of capital, the $400 million, into the early stages. Hitting very briefly on some other states, neighboring states, Wisconsin authorized the program, has seen tremendous successes, over 4,600 jobs created, average salaries of in excess of $60,000 salary. Missouri as well has had tremendous successes with regard to job creation, in excess of 3,500 jobs, an average salary which is 1.8 times the state per capita income, which is a salary of $65,000 on average. You've seen Alabama with a renewal of the program, and as well a very robust program in Colorado with over 4,500 jobs created. So on average nationwide, the portfolio companies have seen average salaries around 1.75 times the per capita income, or in raw numbers around $60,000 average salary. So we're talking about very high quality jobs in addition to very robust job creation numbers. One other thing I would mention just with regard to the structure of the credit, which I think does make this unique from almost any other tax credit you may be presented with, which is that there's a separation between the stimulus and the beneficiary of the credit. If you think about you're creating the beneficiary of the credit being the premium tax investor, the insurance company investor. But the stimulus, which is the access to capital and the improved capital and the new $100 million of capital that would be invested in Wall Street or elsewhere, those two are kept separate, which I think helps avoid some of the lumpy tax code effect that I think this committee has been looking at ways to correct. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and this is for the author, Representative Winkler.
I'm listening.
Okay. Well, and it's maybe not a fair question, Representative Winkler, since you're not on the committee, but we've had, and I support your tax credit, and many like it, and probably offered bills similar to or like it in the past. However, one of the things we've been discussing here in the last couple of weeks in tax committee is tax credits, TIFs, the Jobs V program as corporate subsidies. Personally, I don't think that's the case. I think it's an investment. But if we're going to have a discussion with some of these other programs, I think it's only fair that we, as a committee, address it as well with this program. Again, I support you, Bill. I support the some of the tax credits that we have, the R&D credits that unfortunately this committee has looked at doing away with. I don't think we should, especially in a down economic time. I'd like to see an expansion in your bill in particular. But just for the committee and just for the members, just to let you know, that's kind of the nature of the environment around here, maybe for your testifiers as well, since you're in the industry, that, you know, cutting off these types of credits now is a bad idea. And, you know, if you can make the case a little bit more for some of the committee members, we'd appreciate that.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, I probably tend to agree more with Representative Winchesky about the utility of tax credits for various reasons. I think that there is a, you know, the kind of scenario, the textbook scenario in which a tax credit can lead to a broader public good would be one where there's some kind of market failure or a barrier that is causing some kind of market inefficiency, which happens all the time. And if the tax credit can then create a change of behavior that will address that inefficiency, you may get a net positive result out of your tax credit. And I think that these three bills, while they're all, you know, I think that this final one that we're discussing now, the Small Business Investment Act, but it is a stronger case, perhaps, but they all seek to address some kind of market inefficiency, which is that information barriers and geographic barriers essentially create a disincentive for capital to move to early stage companies in Minnesota. So if we can create a credit, we may actually be opening up a whole new marketplace that otherwise wouldn't be there. And I think that's one of the cases for doing these kinds of credits. And in general, you know, I'm not in favor of broader corporate subsidies just for the sake of doing so. I think the R&D tax credit, and I think works in to the extent that you can create an incentive that is comparatively positive to other states. If you're the only state having an R&D tax credit, for sure it will work. If yours is the best, it will probably work. If you're in the game and somewhat competitive with other states, it'll likely work. I think that's another example. But these three bills all attempt to expand the pipeline of money and expand the pipeline of these of the many new companies that you need to create in order to build and become the larger big job producing companies in the future. So I think that there is a case to be made specifically for these three bills as well, I think, as the R&D tax credit, but I might not agree with you on a lot of other tax credits. And there, Madam Chair, I do have one additional testifier as well.
All right. Representative Zeller wants to follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you just, the two testifiers, give us a kind of a perspective as you work around the country. You know, New York is an example, but where you've seen these be successful, and if they're done away with, again, I am in favor of them, how some of that new incentive or incentive for new jobs, whether it be high technology or small business, has deteriorated.
Mr. Craver or Mr. Korngold, if you'd like to respond.
We can go in order. I'd be happy to. In other states where similar debates have taken place on for the efficacy of tax credits in general, this program tends to be put in a separate category. And I think it's for a lot of reasons. One is because simply just because it offsets the premium tax and then is a mechanism for funneling capital into businesses that ultimately enhances the corporate tax base, I think is one of the real reasons. So it doesn't have some of those same corporate subsidy or distortions of the tax code objections that some other tax credits do. But I think the other reason is, again, just a distinction between so many tax credits have the immediate budgetary impact where, from a public policy standpoint, people are being asked to weigh whether giving this this immediate revenue up today is going to be worth the behavior that they're trying to incentivize. And that's just a difficult decision for people to make, where then they turn to this program and they see that, no, they get all of the investment for years, which is generating benefits with no tax credit at all. And if that money's not invested, then there won't be those tax credits. It's an easier, I think, public policy decision for some people who are otherwise troubled by some of those other issues.
Right. Mr. Craver?
All that I would add is just in spending time in states and sitting through other hearings as I listen to legislation, and as well as my own personal experience as a staffer, actually, for the Missouri Senate once upon a time, looking at the difference between the types of incentives, as Michael mentioned, that the delayed effect of the incentive towards drawing new behavior, and in this case, really taking it one step further and going all the way to a leveraging effect of leveraging capital investment, versus the type of incentive which is more of a direct or immediate benefit. I've found, just anecdotally looking around, there seems to be a lot greater acceptance of the first method and less of the second, but I'm really not an expert in that field, so I'd hate to take it beyond anecdotal evidence.
I actually have two questions. Can you comment on, is there any positive association with our University of Minnesota or other companies like 3M or Medtronic or IBM or Mayo Clinic, for that matter? That's the first question. Is there any association with what we already have in terms of companies or public institutions? And then the second question is, Representative Winkler's earlier bills were actually, you know, trying to target older Minnesotans who have moved outside. I'm interested in, you know, is there any association with trying to retain younger workers?
In terms of the...
Mr. Korngold.
Madam Chair, in terms of the university connection, there's a provision in this program that channels 5% of all profits from any of the investments that are made into both the Angel Network or the university's incubator program. And there was recently an article that we read on how the current funding for the Hughes Incubator Program has been dissipating because it's largely been relying on a royalty stream from drugs that have been developed. And so this would, in some ways, help fill that separate gap. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons that they've been quite supportive of it.
Madam Chair, I think part of the answer to your question is that Minnesota does comparatively well in the medical device field. Is in terms of attracting venture capital from around the country. So, you know, Medtronic and the kind of technology that has spun out of those larger companies and the university. So in that one field, we do pretty well, but our fortunes tend to really rise and fall on the fortunes of that industry, which have been comparatively slower in recent years because of FDA changes and other things that have slowed down the return horizon for those investments.
Okay. Right. Representative Demmer?
No line.
What's that?
No waiting list. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Look, maybe there is a list. Go ahead.
Thank you. A question. We're looking at tax benefits, and I understand what you're saying about the tax credits coming down the path, 3, 4 years, 5 years, whatever this is. Have there been situations in other states where this has been held out, and then the companies do very well, the investors do well, comes time for the tax credit, and they say, well, you're doing very well, maybe you don't need that credit anymore, and it gets taken away. Have you ever seen that, and have you ever seen the threat of that, or what would you think if there was a threat of something like that? How would that impact something like this? So that's kind of a series. Has it ever happened, and has anybody threatened, and what do you think if somebody did threaten or look at doing that, what would be the impact?
All right. Representative Winkler, or... Korngold or Parker?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would just clarify that the tax credit is to the people who have a pool of capital. So ultimately, the threat would be to the insurance companies, and I suppose they're always a target for anybody who has some better ideas of where to spend money. But I have to have the testifiers address history.
And Mr. Korngold?
And that's correct. The historical answer is no, it's never happened. The insurance company investors who contribute all their capital up front are doing so in sort of strict compliance, and they have the oversight to make sure that all of the money is going to be invested into small businesses in Minnesota. Otherwise, they won't be earning a tax credit on the capital that they've contributed. And so, you know, everybody there, as I mentioned, there's several participants, everybody cuts different deals, but all of those deals have that one aspect in common, is that there is some mechanism for if for some reason somebody tried to take the insurance company capital and go to Wisconsin, so it's not going to earn a tax credit, the insurance company has set up a mechanism to make sure that they can deal with that. If a company ends up, to your direct question, as a very successful company, it's never occurred where somebody's come back around to we shouldn't still give the tax credits, because in those good news cases, people, that's usually when the program, frankly, is reauthorized, because people will go back and say, you know, this is the program that really got that company, you know, out of the gate.
All right.
Madam Chair, I do have one testifier for
All right.
Brief addition.
Thank you. Welcome. For the record, please
state your name. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Roger Houtman, and I'm here today on behalf of a group called Waveland Ventures. Waveland is a type of investment firm that is known as a double bottom line fund. I'm not quite sure if everyone's familiar with that. What that means is that in addition to the goal of generating financial returns, like most investors try to do, it seeks to make investments which will also generate socioeconomic and economic development benefits. It does this by investing in small businesses that are typically underserved by traditional capital markets, and due to reasons because of ownership, minority ownership, or more oftentimes because they're located in distressed or rural economic areas that don't seek the attention of the so-called flyover zones that my colleagues here have referred to. The situation regarding underserved small business has really been exacerbated by the current situation in the capital markets. What, you know, it's given tremendous attention and headline attention that Bear Stearns and Wall Street truly, truly has repercussions down to small business owners. And although it's cliche to say what happens on Wall Street affects Main Street, it's certainly most true. On a personal note, I also am an attorney that represents small business entrepreneurs seeking angel, friends and family, and venture funding. So this is a very personal issue to me, as my daily life is spent significantly trying to match capital with entrepreneurs seeking that capital. And, you know, I think all of your efforts today would be applauded by small business owners. Small business historically has been the engine for job growth in the United States. 99.7% of companies in the U.S. are categorized as a small business, and in that definition, we're talking about 500 employees or less, although this particular bill is focused on, I guess, micro business, which would be 100 employees or less. In that category of small business, those companies represent 50% of private sector output and 75% of new job growth each year in the U.S. Yet, those companies are recipients of only 10% of financing in this country. That's what I think we've all sort of alluded to as the void, the funding void, the capital void. As previously mentioned, venture capital has gone upstream into larger deals, banks have retrenched, and angel investment has been difficult to separate angels from their funds. Just anecdotally, one entrepreneur I work with has gone to many angel presentations, and he said if you ask angels for funds, they are glad to give you advice. So I think a program such as Representative Winkler's would go far to try to free up that as a source of legitimate funding for small business owners. This particular program uses tax credits as a lever not only to create investment capital, but almost more importantly, to create a new group of investors that will become permanent residents on the Minnesota investment landscape. One thing that is undebatable is that small business investing is inherently a local endeavor, And the concept is that by supporting the creation of new venture funds, new investment funds, we would be creating an entirely new roster of lead investors that will be here not this year and not next year, but really in perpetuity. Entrepreneurs will often state that as they're making what they refer to as dog and pony shows, they're going around with their PowerPoints and executive summaries trying to solicit investment capital, that they receive very positive indications of interest from investors, but those investors are waiting for a lead investor to step up and really act as the captain on that transaction. This concept of lead investor is important. Statistics show that 80%, setting aside the coastal areas, 80% of capital contributed into small business typically comes from out of state, but yet 80% of transactions have a member in that investment syndicate that's located in state. I'm not a mathematician, but I'm sure you could create some kind of formula there, but what that says is that there is capital available for investment in this country, and it will leave its state boundaries, but only if there's a local investor who champions that transaction, monitors that transaction, and can get in the car and attend board meetings and be there when troubles arise. The number one reason for declining a role as a lead investor is certainly geography, because as I stated, most investors want to be driving distance. A recent study showed that over 10,000 companies that were surveyed over the past 25 years, the median distance to their lead investor was 165 miles. It's a pretty interesting statistic. I mean, I don't know how most people drive, but that's a 2.5-hour drive, I would imagine, in most areas. This program, you know, we truly believe would create a new cadre of investors that would provide small business with capital and also mentoring services, leveraging their networks of professional advisors, helping them with critical decisions, and leading them on the path to becoming, you know, long-term members of this economy. A recent study showed that firms that receive capital from lead investors in close geographic proximity need fewer financing rounds, have longer duration between their financing rounds, have a larger average investment per round, have a higher chance of successful outcome, and quite surprisingly, actually have experienced better operating performance. So in addition to the traditional obvious benefits, I think there's a whole bunch of secondary benefits that a program like this really could precipitate. In summary, we believe that this program uses tax credits efficiently and intelligently, rather than handing them out indiscriminately. And the tax credits are used to not only create capital, but establish a whole new category of professional investors that will establish infrastructure and be long-term contributors to the Minnesota economy.
Thank you. Representative Winkler, do you have another testifier?
I have nothing further, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any questions for the Mr. Hotman? Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify for or against?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I represent Life Science Alley. You've already heard earlier from my partner, Ms. Sandvig, and I won't belabor the issue. We are in support of House File 3538, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to facilitate things and move them along, I also want to say that we are in favor of Representative Lanning's bill, and we would support that one, too. And before my boss gets back in town, who went to college with Representative Lanning, Mr. Gerhardt, I will stand corrected as I was talking the other day about the competition that we do have from North Dakota. It is there, and it is big. So I stand corrected on that issue and appreciate the committee's indulgence. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Griffin, I'm probably one of the few that will admit I went on vacation to North Dakota last September. So I think it's a wonderful state. So. I don't know what the joke is, you know, and frankly, over Easter break, I went to Iowa for vacation. So, you know,
Madam Chair,
my horizons expand, you know, yearly.
Madam Chair is the son of a North Dakotan. He always said good things came from North Dakota.
There you go.
Assuming that was a rhetorical question, I'll try not to get back in. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify for or against? With that...
Madam Chair, I guess my final comment is, I think the testimony and the information that you have indicates that there are barriers and there are inefficiencies in capital market flows to this particular sector of the economy. And these programs, the three bills that I have, two of them have a proven track record of changing behavior based on these tax credits to move capital in those areas. And I think that is exactly the kind of criteria that should be used to judge a tax credit, and I would urge your support.
All right.
And Senator Bach is carrying this last bill in the Senate.
Well, we won't hold that against him. With that, House File 3538 will lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Lanchesky, are you happy where you're at, or you want to come back? Okay. All right. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lanning, would you like to move House File 3855?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move House File 3855. And Madam Chair, we also have delete everything amendments, DE2.
All right.
And I would like to move that to get the bill in the shape that we would like it to be.
All right.
Madam Chair, members, I'm glad the students from Albert Lea are still here. Something that hasn't been said yet today.
Representative Lanning, if it's a delete all, we have to move on it first.
All right.
All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment passes. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I was going to say is, it hasn't been said yet today, but what we're talking about here today is providing incentives for the creation of jobs in Minnesota. And I'm glad that the students from Albert Lea are still here, because what this is all about today is trying to improve the job opportunities they may have as they enter the workforce and hopefully stay in Minnesota. The DE2 amendment that we have before us has narrowed the focus of this bill. We have we originally had a regional program in the bill. We have taken that out because that is now in Representative Marquardt's bill that we heard the other day. And accordingly, I have to point out that the revenue information that you have, you need to note that we have taken out, as I said, the regional investment credit. And in terms of the seed capital investment credit, we are not asking for any additional money. What we're talking about here is being able to use the border city allocation that was approved in the tax bill that was signed earlier this session. And simply what this bill is before you is giving us as a border community and the other border communities the option of using these credits to provide incentives for job creation and development in our border communities. And so no additional requests for funds. We're only asking to be given the flexibility to use the funds that you've already authorized. Again, so that everybody is aware, we're talking about the border cities of East Grand Forks, Dilworth, Moorhead, Breckenridge, and Whartonville. And those are the communities that have been granted these border city credits to this point. And what this bill, as amended, offers is an opportunity for those border communities to compete for job creation with North Dakota. The state of North Dakota here recently enacted a 45% seed capital investment tax credit to spur investment in job creation and startup companies or expansion. And what we're asking for is to be given that tool to use up to a maximum of $112,000 per investment. And in order for us to compete with North Dakota and with Fargo, and given the discussion we've been having of late, Madam Chair, I've got some handouts that we would like to distribute. Have they been distributed? I'd like to call your attention to the North Dakota tax incentive listing. A couple of years ago, Representative Abrams, chair of this committee, did a rather thorough analysis of what we were facing in terms of competing with North Dakota. And Representative Abrams would find today there's even more on the table in terms of what North Dakota can do. Let me just quickly run through this to give you some sense of the kind of competition we face. In North Dakota, they provide sales and use tax exemptions for the purchases of computer and telecommunications equipment. They provide sales and use tax exemptions for purchases of machinery or equipment that is primarily used in manufacturing, agricultural processing, or used solely for recycling. They provide the same sales and use tax exemptions for purchases of construction materials used to construct agricultural processing facilities. They are allowed to give property tax exemptions up to 5 years, property tax exemptions for development. They have, as I mentioned, the income tax credit for investing in a business certified by their Department of Commerce. This is the 45% tax credit that I mentioned. They also have a research expense credit. They have agricultural commodity processing facility investment tax credit. They have tax credits for biomass, geothermal, solar, and wind energy credits. They have a wage and salary credits. They have beginning entrepreneur deductions. They have angel fund investment credits, workforce recruitment credits, and certified nonprofit development corporation investment credit and internship employment credit. They even give credits to employers who have interns work in their companies. So I hope you get some sense of just what it's like trying to compete with a state that goes to the extent that they go. And if you ever have any doubts about the effect of it, come visit us and see the development on the North Dakota side of the river versus what's happening on the Minnesota side. And you'll see that these kinds of incentives have really made a big difference. I have to tell you that long-time Moorhead resident who has started several companies, young entrepreneur, very successful, started successfully, a number of companies, already sold some. He wanted to start some new companies, and he wanted to be in Minnesota. He wanted to stay in Minnesota. But when he took a look, particularly at this 45% investment tax credit and what he could do to raise investment capital in North Dakota, it was a no-brainer. He now is starting those new companies in North Dakota, not in Minnesota, not in Moorhead. And so, Madam Chair and members, I also want to call your attention to the handout from the Brian Walters, the Greater Fargo-Moorhead Economic Development Corporation. And in spite of the fact that we compete with North Dakota and Fargo, we try to work with them because we realize we're one market, and we can do some things together, hopefully, that will bring jobs to our metropolitan area. And you will notice in his letter that that organization very much supports the bill that we have before you now. And so I call your attention to that as well. Well, Madam Chair, I would like to now, if I might, turn over to Mr. Scott Hutchins, who's the Community Services Director for the City of Moorhead. And Mr. Hutchins has been involved in these border city competition issues for the last 30 plus years and has been very much involved in administering our border city program.
Welcome. For the record, state your name.
Scott Hutchins. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As Representative Lanning pointed out, the effects of the competitive disparities are very evident along Minnesota's northwestern border. If you look at the communities in North Dakota, Grand Forks, Fargo, and Wahpeton, their Minnesota counterparts are substantially less population, and the economic vitality as a result in taxable sales, economic base, commercial industrial base, employment, is also less than what we would hope it to be. And we certainly, I believe, over the years have through the Border City program stemmed what was a critical outflow of business in the early years and stabilized the economy. And with tools such as these, we hope to build the economy and provide for those entrepreneurs and beginning business opportunities in the area of technology and the like to make those investments that are otherwise, in our case, being made across the river with a tool that is similar to what is available across the river to have them made in Minnesota for the benefit of Moorhead and the benefit of Minnesota. We are working together in those areas that we can effectively collaborate with our partners in the area of attempting to grow our economy broadly. And with a tool such as this, we feel we have an opportunity to realize what is a fair share of that business development activity that will ensue in our region. But for having the tool, as is noted in Mr. Walter's letter, the credit has been well received in North Dakota and well received by investors in startup eligible type businesses. And we believe the same can be the case, if not even better, in our community and for the benefit of Minnesota. Appreciate your
time. All right. Thank you, Mr. Hessen. Any questions for members? Representative Marshall.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members, and thank you, Representative Lanning, for bringing this forward. And a couple of those cities are in the district I represent, Dilworth and Breckenridge, and I think Representative Lanning talked to the kind of the challenges we have when we go against North Dakota and Fargo and so forth. And what I like about this, it still allows the option whether or not the border cities want to use it. It's within an existing structure, which is very nice too. And it also looks at the high tech type of things, which gets more in line with what we're actually competing with, and that's good. And I, you know, one of the advantages we've had, I think, on the Minnesota side, when all things were considered, maybe outside of business, we're like in the property tax area. And I see now where Governor Hoeven, the North Dakota governor, has adopted a plan looking at a $300 million plan with $200 million in property tax relief and another $100 million into schools. So all of a sudden, where property taxes, actually, when you can, because they don't put as much into their schools, have been kind of a benefit. That's now going to be another challenge that we're going to have if North Dakota lowers property taxes. That's been kind of their high taxes. Representative Sellers, to say he's a North Dakota native. So I very much appreciate this bill, strongly support this bill, and appreciate your efforts, Representative Lanning.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Sure.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. I would just like to point out that we've got definitions here that only border cities, of course, are involved. They have to be primary sector businesses, and there's a whole set of criteria that have to be met by deed, by the community, and in order to get approved as a qualified business by deed. And so we've got, I think, all of the protections in here to make sure that this only goes to qualified businesses and businesses who meet all the criteria that we've laid out in the amendment.
Representative Lanning, I haven't had a chance to read your bill. Is it for all border cities, or just your area?
It's for those that are, Madam Chair, it's for those that are already defined in law and have been for the last 25 plus years. That's East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, and Hortonville.
Okay.
They're all specifically mentioned under this border city definition under in statute.
All right. Well, Mr. Hutchins, I think one thing you've been really lucky on is that you border the Dakotas, and they've done a really poor job of promoting the Dakotas. I mean, they name their national parks the Badlands. I mean, who wants to go there? I mean, you know, so. Okay, Madam Chair, handle it.
Madam Chair, I was actually going to defend your trip to my home state earlier, but now I probably would suggest that maybe at no. And to Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is, Representative Lanning and I have known each other for probably almost 15, 16 years now, and if there's one individual who's been consistent about this, And it has been, a good-spirited pro-business discussion that he's had. It's not been the Friends to the South in South Dakota, where it's kind of a more of a food fight or a fist fight, a verbal fist fight. Representative Lanning has always, when he was Mayor Lanning, has always been a pro-business discussion. We want to have more jobs. We understand what they have. And you're right. One of my good friends who works in Governor Hogan's office said, when you've got nothing, you offer a little bit and you get something, we come out ahead. So you have to understand what we're up against when, again, if you can do just a little bit of something to pull somebody over the border, and unfortunately, that's what's happened. And to compete like this on a border state and to keep it about jobs and good jobs, I think is a much better job than some of those guys in the South Dakota development or whoever's running commercials on our radio stations here. I think this is a much better way to go about it, and part of Ben Lanning for his consistency and for bringing the bill forward.
All right, thank you. With that, we'll lay over House File 3855 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
As amended, Madam Chair.
As amended. Yes,
thank you.
I guess it was the Badlands. Well, Representative Deal Forest, maybe before you start, you could clue me in. Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up?
Yeah, so I don't offend your
Just up the street in Roseville, Madam Chair. As a matter of fact, I was neighbors growing up with Mindy Greiling, who lives over on Woodbridge Street, and I'm on Grandview there. So right up there in Roseville. The Greilings were just on the other side of Materian Park there. So along with Representative Dean. Folks know Dean's Tavern up there on Rice Street. That's in the Matt Dean family. Matt Dean and I are Roseville kids by trade. So still
clean
love
cut.
The hometown.
Clean cut, too. All right. Representative DeLaForest, would you like to move House File 3632?
Sure. Madam Chair, I would move House File 3632 and that it be laid over. Obviously, the purpose of the bill today is not to take action, but more or less to talk about things. As a matter of fact, Madam Chair, a little bit of trivia here. I confess that House File 3632, I dusted off another former representative's bill who served in the recent past year. So I wonder if anybody would recognize the author of this bill or can read the bill and try and figure out who the author was. And so, Madam Chair and colleagues, I'm not going to go through the bill line and verse because it's not my intent. Chairman Chesty was kind enough to recognize my request that sometimes we do what engage in a bit of advice I got a long time ago, and that sometimes put your feet up and sort of think about the future. And when we think about property taxes, we've sort of got an issue. And, of course, there's always issues the legislature deals with, but we're really on a collision course, I think, with respect to property taxes. Now, Representative Marquardt, you certainly recognize that. What I find interesting is, you know, we're conservatives, we're liberals, we're Republicans, we're Democrats, but I've had so many good discussions with colleagues across the spectrum about this issue who all recognize the problem with property taxes. And so I thought it would be nice, and Representative Winchester agreed with me, to maybe have a little bit of discussion. And by the way, I also invited some of the players in the property tax system to give us some thoughts today as well, local units of government and businesses in particular. So I'm glad we'll just take a couple minutes to talk about the future, because obviously I sort of get to run away from the issue in some respects. So I'll still be a taxpayer, but you certainly will have to wrestle with the issue in future years and perhaps the near future. But I briefly just add my comments about thinking about property taxes in admittedly sort of a bold way. You know, with the income tax, of course, it's complex, but you know, if you're a taxpayer, you can hire an advocate. You can spend $40 at Liberty Tax or H&R Block, and you can have an advocate who has a fiduciary duty and a responsibility to help you navigate and understand the income tax. And the sales tax is easy in the sense that it's fairly simple math, and the taxpayer has a lot of control over it in many respects. If you don't want to pay that Hennepin County sales tax on that plasma television, perhaps you drive over to another county or order it from another jurisdiction. But the property tax is uniquely different than that. I think all of us would agree it's extremely complex, and just about nobody understands it fully. And it's not because folks aren't intelligent. It's because you need a PhD in 20 years in the legislature and 25 years on the taxes committee to understand what the heck's going on with market value and assessments and growth and net capacities and the like and different classes, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's fundamentally unfair in many respects to have this tax over which people they feel they have very little control and they don't understand it. We've all had constituents that say, I go to Truth in Taxation, or I try to contest my assessed value, and I just sort of get acronyms skewed back at me from well-meaning staff members at the county and city level, but nobody feels like they really have an advocate in a sense. And so I asked the question about whether or not we really should maybe be taxing property at all, especially in 2008, when it seems that property wealth has less and less of a nexus to ability to pay. And we frequently talk about an aging population on a fixed income. They find it harder and harder to pay the property taxes because the property might be worth a lot and it's an illiquid asset, but then they got to get liquidity and cash to pay the property tax bill. And I just wrap up with just one anecdote that I thought about today driving in. We think about seniors on fixed incomes, and that's certainly an important consideration in the whole property tax debate. But I've got a friend, really a good friend of mine, childhood friend, and I just saw him last weekend. He and his wife are just simple, hardworking folks. They're high school graduates. He works for a truck accessory store in retail. She works for a medical device store, you know, selling prosthetics and hearing aids and wheelchairs and the like. And my friend is very close to an uncle who never had a family, never married, never had kids. And the uncle built, he's a carpenter, a very nice small place on Forest Lake. Right on Forest Lake, it was beautiful. And the uncle passed away, and he left title to the property to my friend. And it was a godsend because my friend was renting. They hadn't been able to afford a home. And so they got in there. And it was sort of a dream come true. They had a place to live. Who wouldn't want to live on Forest Lake? I certainly drank a heck of a lot of beer on that dock over the short time that they lived there. But as you can imagine, they had a difficult time keeping that place. They had a very difficult time. And it was really tough to see my friend sell that property because he was so emotionally invested in it. He was very close to this uncle. And they had to give that up and move away. So just we leave that anecdote as well, because we're all informed by personal experiences as well down here at the legislature. And that just hit me this morning as I was driving in. Mike and Julie, my friends, lost that property. And so for that reason, I'm hoping that you'll share your thoughts, and I'm glad that in a formal sort of way we're starting to talk about this important issue, and I certainly look forward to hearing from other folks. As I said, I admit that this may be a good idea, it may be a rotten idea. I'm not quite sure, but I find it interesting that the liberals and conservatives around the table can shake hands and say, we got a property tax problem. So I'd be happy to hear from everybody, from the audience and from members of the committee. Again, Madam Chair, thank you.
Well, Representative DeLaForest, you have quite a few testifiers here, so how do we want to proceed here? Do you want to go first, Representative Demmer? All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative DeLaForest, interesting idea. Could you explain the mechanics a little bit? I was reading through the bill, the description about the sales tax levy. How would you replace the money that locals get? Can you explain the mechanism and what your thought process would be? I'm intrigued.
Representative DeLaForest.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Yaros had a similar question, I know. And that's why I was reluctant to sort of use a bill, because it gets into some of the years, and obviously it's a serious question. If we were going to back, is it about $6.5 billion, Representative Marquardt, and state and local around in there?
$7 billion.
Okay, a little over $7 billion. we got an issue. I don't think it's realistic to presume that we're just going to take a $7 billion hit to government. So, you know, Representative Demmer, I know that Michigan had something similar. They didn't abolish property taxes, but they seriously reformed the issue and they put the effective date out and they convened a committee that was assigned to deal with the issue. But obviously, you know, the sky's the limit. It could be replaced by income taxes to make the system more progressive. And, of course, within the income tax, you've got latitude about how the income tax bears that, especially with the three different tiers we have. Or it could be the sales tax. And, of course, there's a question that begged Representative Demmer, what do cities do? If we don't allow cities to levy property tax, what do they do? Would they be totally reliant on state aid? Somehow I get the feeling they may not be comfortable with that idea. But or do we allow them to institute a sales tax? Or even something that's only in a couple jurisdictions to tax income. I know New York City, for example, and that's different than Minnesota, but they can levy an income tax. And it's certainly a broad issue. There's no doubt about it. And I wouldn't come presuming to say I know how it ought to be replaced. It would be replaced in some fashion, I'm sure, at least in a revenue-neutral fashion. But how would it be replaced? And I admit that's an incredible question. It's a Gordian knot to try and cut through, and probably one of the reasons that we haven't considered this in a serious way.
Okay. Representative Yarrow?
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, well, I've been, one of the biggest reasons I came here was to protect the Minnesota miracle. Yeah. I replaced a person who voted against that tax. I thought it was a good idea, but I think this is better yet. I haven't... I mean, of course, Minnesota miracle was destroyed, and, you know, we know where we are, and property taxes are going up again. I don't think there's any country that imposes property taxes. The most archaic and unfair tax, it was created to tax wealth. Just because someone has a nice home or a nice business building, doesn't mean that they have an income. There's no bottom line. You still have to pay it, and if you don't pay it in 7 years, it's taken away from you. It's really, so income and maybe sales tax expansion. Right now, our sales tax is only paid by individuals. Businesses are not paying for legal fees and advertising and so on. So I think that's the way, and you know, I think it would be the best way to do it, and I hope, put my name on there and we'll figure out. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Yarrow.
Representative Yarrow, there you have...
As I said, Madam Chair, it's ironic. This is an issue. I think there's broad agreement, and of course the devil is truly in the details, but Representative Yarrow can give you an example from the area I'm privileged to represent. And 30 years ago, land was really cheap in Ham Lake. They were practically giving it away, and so there were folks of moderate means who moved to Ham Lake, and they bought 20 acres, they bought 30 acres. And they're still there because that's their home. That's where they raised their kids. And that's where they experienced a lot of the highs and lows we all experience in life. I mean, it's their home, truly. What do you suppose the property tax bill might be looking like these days if you're sitting on 20 acres in Ham Lake? I can tell you the retail value, even in this down market, you can pay $700,000, you can pay $1 million for a home on there, and you can pay $500,000 for raw land. So that's just another example. I agree with you truly that increasingly, property wealth is not a true proxy for ability to pay, especially again with land illiquid. If you get a $100,000 tax bill, you can't just tap into your land to help pay the bill. Real estate is the most illiquid of assets.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative LaForest, you know, I guess you forgot libertarian too when you were talking about liberal conservatives.
Yeah.
And he wanted those. you know, what do you do though, and you're right, Brookson, you know, property taxes are very unfair, but sales taxes are just as effective. Minnesota has a fairly progressive sales tax, it doesn't apply to employees. But how do you put a sales tax for a city like the city that has zero sources, or Buell that has one convenience store? You know, or I'm sure a lot of other rural communities in your district that have no stores at all. So that's not going to work unless we, you know, have a statewide share of the wealth type thing. But we got rid of the Minnesota miracle and the share of the wealth type thing because Edina needed more help for its school taxes. So, you know, and so did East Prairie and Egypt. And I just don't know how you Dakota income tax would be great, but if Minnesota charges income on all those people from Chicago and that got those beautiful cabins on Lake Vermilion, can we actually make the Walmarts and out of the world pay taxes because they got the best lawyers in the world? And I'd be curious to see what their income tax in Minnesota is, corporate income tax versus what their sales are, what their property tax is in Minnesota. So these are the questions. You know, you're coming around. You're getting back to those BSL roots that you were raised in with BSL also, but I don't know if this is the right way to do it because my roommate, Representative Duncan, actually went up, and I believe he had Mr. Michael or maybe Ms. Manchie or somebody worked with him, and I think he told me that if we had a pre-tax of 9 or 10% on everyone's income, that we could eliminate all taxes in the state of Minnesota. But those 55 richest people that I see, they're going to fascinate me before that ever happens. Because they'll never put up with it. They'll never share their wealth like that, which would be fair. Forbes wanted a flat tax, but that was after they hired all those Philadelphia lawyers to hide all their money. Then they were going to have a flat tax. So I like your idea. You're coming around. I wish you'd stay and come over to our side of the aisle so we get that veto override. I'm not going to wipe your knees.
Yeah. You know what, Representative DeLaForest, you know, what's the answer?
Well, I did actually, Madam Chair, Representative Drew Covina, so might be kind of sore because I told him he was falling out of favor with the DFL Catholic or wing of my family. After the twins vote, still, as I said, there are three photos at the dining room table. There's the Pope, JFK, and Rukavina. It's kind of like the gold, silver, and bronze, but Rukavina's in the bronze position at the dining room table now. You're still there. Representative Rukavina, you're absolutely right. Certainly, if this was a no-brainer and this was an easy idea, someone besides me would have come up with it first before that, but there are certainly flaws, and I think another flaw in it, first of all, you'd probably have to go to some kind of share the wealth model. You'd have to make it work. But I imagine Mr. Michael were probably introducing a greater deal of volatility into the system as a whole, I would think, with the general proposition, because you're going from sort of that three-legged stool down to a two-legged stool. And as I said, certainly I don't think that this is the silver bullet to solve anything, because we would have done it years ago. But I think it's important to start discussing this, Representative Rukavina. I don't argue with the flaws that you find, but I think what we all recognize is the current system is becoming more and more unfair. And I worry that we're starting to rely on it more and more for reasons we frequently fight about, like when you see the Wolverine into the Edina rabbit cage here. But the answer would, in part, I think, have to be some sort of share of the wealth. Because you're right, Representative Group. I mean, in some jurisdictions that, you know, to impose a sales tax or even income tax probably isn't real feasible for them.
Representative Winchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative DeLaForest, I really appreciate you offering this bill. I think it's a really honest approach to the problem, and it focuses the mind. And I think I want to hear your testifiers because I think they're to be interesting to hear people begin to talk about this. I think realistically people understand where this might be able to go this year, but it's hitting the nail on the head. It is the most unfair tax. It is not based on the ability to pay in large parts. There are, in some parts it is, but in large parts it's not. And it's the issue that is the most complex. As you stated, and I have to say that when I first came to the legislature and got on the tax committee, you know, I was a city council member and all I was interested in was the property tax. I mean, so I got here and it was just like, wow, we can debate all these property tax issues and, you know, have all these discussions about LGA and fiscal disparities and market value credit and assessed value and all these things. And it actually takes, I think, tax committee members a while to even see that there are issues besides the property tax, and that the income tax and the sales tax and all the other things going on in the tax code have an impact on people's lives. But I think elected officials spend the majority of their time, and if you look at bill introductions, the majority of bills are introduced on the property tax. And this is kind of the sort of drug in the tax world that members are drawn to. And I think it's because no matter where you are politically, people understand that it is the most complicated tax, and depending what district you're standing in, you think it's unfair to your district. And I think that's kind of what most legislators share in common, no matter what part of the state they represent. So I really appreciate you bringing it forward, and I think it's just interesting to have the discussion.
Representative
Madam Chair, I'm happy to step aside and turn the microphone over to testifiers, to the folks who are living with the property tax.
We have one more member.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry.
Representative Markford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dale, of course, you are moving in the right direction. I will certainly say that. And, you know, you bring that up. You know, one of the reasons you have so many problems with property taxes is complex, like you said. You know, how many times each year do we go through and staff takes us through that process, and you still have to look through it again. And the other frustration, as I mentioned before, it's the only tax that government is involved on both ends. Unlike an income, it's based on your job, a sales is what you buy, but the government sets your value, not, you know, besides the rate at the end. You know, they're in on both ends, and that creates a lot of other problems. And as you mentioned also, there are not, with property taxes, there are not a lot of vendors. I mean, there's a monopoly of, you know, what you can purchase with that. It's this city, this county, and you just can't move your house to with other taxes. But getting back to the, and this is a great discussion, and I appreciate you bringing this forward, but, you know, you do have that three-legged stool. And the one thing about the property tax is you have a linkage with services that you don't get when you come down with state and income tax. I mean, you don't, it's great equalizers, income and sales tax, but you lose that link. And in the 2001 property tax form was to try to get to that link. So if you're going to pay out of your pocket, you know what you're getting, and if the city increases that service, there's going to be that link there. And the other thing that others have brought up is the stability. Of course, property tax is probably the most stable tax. Mm-hmm. And that leads to the whole debate, I think, getting back to what Representative Linkowski is trying to do is, you know, if you were to go to a system that relied primarily on income and sales tax, you would really have to broaden those bases out to make them more stable. So, you know, if you would remove that onto everything else. But I think the way you kind of solve a lot of that is going to this ability to pay, which is already in the mechanism with the PTR program, but like the homestead credit state refund in the proposal last year, where you say, you know, you limit to 2% of your income, where you get, I mean, that's a way in which you get around a lot of the senior citizen who purchased this home 20 years ago at $50,000 and now it's worth $300,000 in the suburbs. Their income has stayed the same, but, you know, and that helps solve that problem. You can base it on the ability to pay. But I do appreciate you bringing this forward.
Well, Representative Markhart, I want to say I think that property taxes were invented by men as a part of not wanting to do their honeydew project. Because my husband has used that excuse any number of times about the government sets your value, and he would just love to remodel the basement, but that would be about the time somebody would come in and, you know, reassess the value of the house, so can't do it. So, anyway, sorry. What was that deal for us? Do you ever use that excuse?
Madam Chair, no, I just, as a matter of fact, finished my basement about 3 years ago, and and they came by. As Representative Markhart, speaking of that, it's interesting because property tax, and I think people can argue that income taxes can be invasive. I know some folks have gotten in trouble with the IRS snooping around in folks' returns, but has anybody ever gotten that notice from the county, when, you know, let us into your house to look at your basement, or else we're going to assume the worst about what you did to your house? And so I was troubled because the libertarian in me said, forget it, I'm not letting government come and look at my house. And then, of course, there was a fiscal conservative and said, well, get them in here and take a look at my workmanship. I'm sure that they will lower their expectations with respect to increasing the assessed value of my house. So I was in a quandary, and what I ended up doing is I put it in my too-hard-to-do box and ignored it, and they assumed the worst.
All right. Well, Representative Lanning wants to comment on your workmanship again.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and it's a fun discussion. I'm wondering if anybody has ever taking a look at how much the ability to deduct property taxes from our income taxes has cost the state over the years. That if we didn't have property taxes, we couldn't deduct the property taxes that we pay from our income. Does anybody know, have any clue as to how much that might be, how much it really costs us in lost revenue.
Mr. Michael?
the default.
Madam Chair, I did not bring the tax expenditure budget to committee, and so I'm unwilling to sort of rely on my memory as to those, as to that number, but we can easily get it for you.
All right, well, it's been fun, but Representative De La Forest does have a number of testifiers. Come on down. Join the fun. For the record, state your name.
My name is Kay Rocco, and I am here on behalf of NIOP, which is the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties, representing commercial real estate developers and owners, as well as the tens of thousands of business tenants that we have in our properties across the state. Very deliberate increases in CI property taxes was a single issue that galvanized NIOP's public policy efforts in the mid-80s. And through changes in the classification system and actions on all levels of government, the property tax burden was shifted significantly to business properties, to the extent that by 1994, the effective rate according to House research was 5.94%. Take the value of your house, take 6% of it, and that was the level of property taxes that business properties were paying in at that moment. And so through a lot of work by a lot of people, the legislature began to realize that business properties were just simply carrying too much of a load on the property tax system. And so starting in the late 90s and culminating in 2001, a lot of changes were made to the property tax system, which raised all properties' effective rates. So by 2007, for example, the effective rate on a business property was 3%, while a home's effective rate, this is these are statewide averages, was 1%. So for every $100 of value, a business property was paying $3, and for every $100 worth of value, a homeowner is paying $1. But even though our effective rate was reduced in essence by half, we keep hearing over and over and over again since 2001, and not by every legislator, I must add, that business properties got too much of a break and we're still not paying our fair share. So as a result of that, particularly in the other body, the tax bills always contain an increase in the statewide property tax. So we get just a little defensive about facing that issue year after year. So our observations on the system, first of all, the classification side of it creates favored properties by taxing them at a less rate and unfavored properties by taxing them at a higher rate. And so as a result, we sometimes think that if you're not paying the true cost of the services you're asking for, maybe you're going to ask for a little bit more. So we think, of course, that all properties should be treated the same regardless of their use. And then this has been said ad nauseum, but it is a complicated system. It doesn't make any difference if you're at the water cooler, having coffee with your relatives, cocktails, whatever it is. Everybody complains about the property tax system. They don't understand. They just don't understand who's making the decisions. They don't understand where the money's going. And then, to top it all off, all levels of government do this to each other. And no wonder you've got property taxpayers and citizens who get very cynical. And particularly, this goes on in the city that I live in. It's always this. And then the last thing I want to say about it is, homeowners clearly are not aware of how they're being subsidized through the property tax system by their employers in the community in which they live and work. We cannot comment on this bill in front of you guys. I mean, we just don't have any idea whether this is a good thing, a bad thing, or what machinations should take place. But we do believe that with any system, the amount of the tax being paid should be extremely transparent to the taxpayer. A taxpayer needs to know who's accountable for the money and what the money is being used for, and of course, all property taxpayers should be treated equally. And thank you so much for inviting us to comment this morning.
All right, thank you. Questions? All right.
Madam Chair, Representatives. I'm Bob Fenwick. I am a Cook County Commissioner, and I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties as their immediate president. And in the interest of time, very quickly, I'm decorated today. I'll do a couple of things. Ask you to join us this evening at 5:30. We're down here for our legislative conference. It's a joint conference involving counties, school districts, cities, and townships, and we would encourage you to stop over and visit with us. 5:30 legislative get-together at the Crown Plaza. I am not going to belabor the issue of all of the technicalities we're talking about here today. I'm only going to drop to the bottom line and represent AMC in one fashion. Representative Marquardt has heard us call for this. He's often been to our meetings of our AMC board and our legislative steering committee. We, of course, this issue is near and dear to our hearts. We talk about it all the time, but we always come down to one final conclusion, and the legislation that is being brought forward brings us to that conclusion again. The time is now, the time is ripe, the time is not passable that there be a joint group of individuals representing state, local, school districts, townships, cities that sit down and really hash this issue out. I understand that in hearing the governor's talk early on about the state of the state, that he was calling for a commission to talk about property taxes. If I remember right, that would have included mostly business people within the community in our state. But we would ask for you, because of the serious questions that you're asking here, and the fact that in asking those questions, they become almost unanswered, so difficult to answer, that the joint group of lawmakers and local officials sit down and really honestly hash out the problems of the property tax system, which is inevitably linked to the whole system of taxation in the state, and really talk about the possibility of real tax reform. Because that is what this legislation begs. It has to go forward. The fact that the legislation is asking that question only brings it to a point where it needs to be discussed. The last thing I'll mention is I need to leave here very quickly. I have the wonderful honor of giving a scholarship award to a high school student from my county. It's an AMC scholarship award. I'm about a half an hour, 45 minutes late now. That is very near and dear to me, too. Perhaps more important today than property taxes. But I would sit for any questions briefly because I do have to go if anybody has any of me.
There is a question, Representative Mowry.
Madam Chair, a real tax question. Are you the same Bob Fenwick that was a famous baseball player at the U?
If you put emphasis on famous, I'm not sure, but yes, I am. I am. And so I hold the education process in this state very near and dear to my heart, too.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Henry. Mr. Michael, do you want me to? And I have a note from Mr. Michael. Fiscal year 2008, amount of the tax expenditure for itemized deduction for real estate taxes is $156 million. For the record, Jeannie.
And members of the committee, my name is Jan Callis, and I'm the mayor of Minnetonka. I'm also the president this year of the Municipal Legislative Commission, which is an association of 14 suburban communities. As you might guess, I'm testifying here in opposition to this bill. And I want to start by putting a human face, just as Representative DeLaForest said, on the people who benefit from the property tax. In our communities, when there's a fire, people expect the fire department to come. They expect police services. They expect clean water from their tap. They expect natural resource protection. They expect parks. They expect nuisance properties to be dealt with, particularly as we talk about foreclosures. And they expect our elections this fall to be run in an efficient and reasonable manner. And all of that is paid for in two ways by our communities, either the property tax or by fees. And so while we understand and we support the need to look at the system of taxation in Minnesota, we support a comprehensive examination of the whole system, understanding that no tax is perfect, and it's really the way we administer it and we apply it that makes the difference. And so we ask you to look at the entire system of taxation. We hear from our residents on the property tax. We understand those issues as well as you do. But we also know it's important to our residents. We'd also call your attention to the importance of the property tax in backing up the bonding authority of the state of Minnesota, our school districts, our cities, and our counties. And so we urge you to make smart legislation in this regard, and we encourage this conversation. Thank you.
Representative DeForest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mayor, certainly you have services you want to provide and they need to be paid for. Certainly. My question to you briefly is, we're talking about property taxes. Do you think that I've got two questions. A, do you think that's the best way to produce revenues for the city, just in a philosophical sense? I mean, would a sales tax be better in your opinion? I'm interested in that. And second, I imagine that you feel, however, that there is some unfairness because you have unfunded mandates that you have to cover through property taxes. Either the federal or the state government says to your city, thou shall, and then we don't give you the money to pay for it, and so in a sense, and I hope the school boards are here to testify because I've got an anecdote in that regard, but essentially I'd like to know if you think the property tax is the best way for your city to produce revenues more than anything else.
We think the best way is a system that is reliable and that satisfies the needs of the cities, and that can be done through a number of different ways. We recognize the burden that property tax places on our residents. We have seniors on fixed incomes. We understand there's not a nexus between wealth, ability to pay tax, and property, but we also see that it's an important part of the system that we have in place in this state for taxation. And so our urging really is to think comprehensively about the solution and to understand from a tax policy that you need a broad base of taxes, because if you put all your eggs in one basket, you're likely to end up with scrambled eggs rather than whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. So again, we understand the need to look at this, but we also want to make sure we can provide the services that our residents expect and that, as you say, the state often does not finance and expects us to provide. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Linton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for the mayor, or maybe Mr. Michael, just thinking about the MLC cities as a group. And I don't know, if this is a fair question to ask, but just thinking off the top of my head, I'm guessing the MLC cities as a group probably have the most ability to raise revenue compared to other cities beyond the property tax as a percentage of their spending. And I could be wrong on that. I just wondered if you could comment on that. I think about my own city, and I think it spends about $100 million a year, but it only levies about $40 million a year on the property tax. So there's some cities have a lot of ability to do a lot of revenue raising, and that's why those cities often don't receive LJ and things like that. They shouldn't, because they have a lot more revenue streams going on. But do you know that, if the MLC cities as a group have more ability to gain revenue beyond the property tax than the other 800 and some cities in the state?
Ms. Callison?
I would guess your assumption is correct, that we do have greater ability than a lot of other communities. Certainly we are communities that originally were brought together because we pay fiscal disparities, and so we are part of that pooling of tax revenue that I think is a benefit to the metro system, but I think your assumption is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you again.
For the record, state your name.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to thank Representative DeForest for alerting us to the bill and asking us to share our thoughts with the committee. So I guess I would encourage two quick amendments. One, I think we'll have to shorten the name of Representative Marquardt's division. We'll have to lop off the first part of that division's title. We won't need property tax relief anymore. And then secondly, we might have to increase the appropriation for LGA by about $1.6 billion. But I would like to share with you, as I begin to talk here, a little bit of this issue, because the League of Cities and the other city groups have been working around this issue, actually, for a number of years. And I think in light of what happened in the 2003 budget crisis for the state, we started to look at the issue of the property tax and state aids and the whole system of state, local, intergovernmental finance. And we realize that this is it's a system that's very much on the edge, because we know there's a lot of rough edges with it. We know there's the need for reform, and I think Representative DeForest's constitutional amendment really illustrates that for us today. But what I'm distributing today are two handouts. One is the results of some recommendations that a task force that we compiled of our city officials put together in 2005, and I think there's some good food for thought. I'm not going to go through that in great detail with you today, but there's some good thoughts in there about tax reform principles, including property tax reform principles. The second handout is actually a graphic that shows you the importance of the property tax to city budgets. And as that's being distributed, I'll just briefly mention that we looked at the property tax, well, city budgets from 1965 through the current 2005 through the state auditor reports. And you'll see on that graph, the middle part of the stack bar graph shows you the importance of the property tax, largely the property tax for city finances. It's about a third to 40% of a typical city budget. So if we do lop off that property tax, it would be a significant loss of revenue. And that should be of no surprise. I know everyone knows that. Secondly, if you look at the pie chart down below, it gives you an idea that we're not the only ones that rely on the property tax. Clearly, we have schools, counties, special taxing districts, and as well, not represented on there are the townships that also levy property taxes, so we would have to think about their financial operations. But let me just kind of conclude briefly and turn it over to Patty and maybe stand for some questions to say what Representative De La Forest has suggested and what Commissioner Fenwick suggested is something that's not very new. And I went through some of the old league files, and I found in 1917, believe it or not, we've been around since 1913, but here's a group that has been meeting or met for approximately 40 years that was called the Minnesota State Tax Conference. And it was a group of a number of different people that were representing local governments, farmers, businesses, that got together to discuss tax issues of the day. And if you want to see the minutes that go all the way back to 1917, I have this for you. But interestingly, you'll see a lot of the same issues that you're raising, Representative De La Forest, the issues that were discussed in 1917. These are not issues that have gone away. They are not issues that will likely go away. It is very interesting reading if you'd like to take some time to look at that. But Madam Chair, I think that we would encourage, as Commissioner Fenwick indicated, that perhaps it is time that we sit back and conduct another Latimer-type tax study commission to think about how we finance government in Minnesota, because clearly the property tax has become an onerous part of the tax burden. We have felt the pressure at the local level of the aid cuts and the shifts of responsibility. So we should look at the revenue side. One last comment. We should also think, Representative De La Forest in particular, not just about the revenue raising of how we finance government, but maybe also about who provides services to our citizens. I think, ultimately we wrestle with issues like who should be providing elections. Largely those are run by local governments. Should that be a state responsibility? So we should also think creatively about what level of government maybe is best responsible for providing some of those services. With that, Madam Chair, I turn it over to Patty to mention some of the AMM.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson, for the record.
Good morning. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm representing Metro Cities. We represent 86 cities in the 7-county metro area, and we appreciate the opportunity to comment on House File 3632 and Representative De La Forest's interest in having the conversation on property taxes. Property taxes are the primary revenue source that cities use to fund basic services like police and fire, water and sewer, and the like. If you change the balance of that three-legged stool, the property, sales, and income tax three-legged stool, this would have significant impacts on our revenue system and how services are funded throughout the state. That said, we do support a comprehensive conversation and taking a look at some of these issues. Last year, there was this kind of conversation has already started with the creation of the Budget Trend Study Commission that was created last year by the legislature. I believe it was Representative Chesky's legislation. And that group is tasked with looking at the impacts of future demographics on our state revenue and expenditure system as we look forward. I think they're supposed to look forward to about 25 years into the future. They're also tasked with looking at how to improve efficiency in our tax and expenditure systems and looking at how to make our revenue and expenditure systems more easy to understand and administer. So we think that that group has a good start on this conversation, and we know that this is a major task, and we would ask that as that group and the legislature consider changes to our revenue system in the future, that they keep in mind the importance of the state and local fiscal partnership to cities. Our policies oppose levy limits, and they also oppose including any kind of tax on expenditure limits in the Constitution. Our policies we believe that these kinds of policies impede local budget decision making. They eliminate flexibility on the part of the legislature or local governments to respond to unanticipated needs or fluctuating economic situations. So we would, as this committee looks forward to having this conversation, again, we would support a strong state and local fiscal partnership that emphasizes strong stewardship and accountability for public resources, predictability in revenue sources, adequate revenues that allow cities to meet the needs of their constituents, and an equitable finance and revenue system that values citizens receiving adequate levels of services at similar levels of taxation, and one that provides assistance to cities and taxpayers to account for overburdens and that reduces tax burden disparities among cities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. All right. Welcome. For the record, please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Grace Schwab, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state of Minnesota. And we have some concerns about this bill. Unlike the other governmental entities you'll see come before you today, we actually have voter-approved operating levy referendums and voter-approved building referendums. And in order to use those revenues to bond for our building, we have to look at a sales tax or an income tax to somehow back the bond to build those buildings and go forward with that issue. So we've actually added another level of complexity to this. We were worried when the 100% funding of K-12 education came into effect. Our organization was very vocal in saying we have concerns about that. We do feel the property tax adds some kind of stability to education funding that we know we can count on from year to year, but are certainly open to having that discussion. I think you're seeing disparities and debt service, which is the ability for a district to have a dollar, be valued a dollar across the state, really showing forth in this year's education bill. If you look at House File 1812, you'll find that debt service in the state of Minnesota this year is at $14 million. In 2 years, it'll be down to $7 million. So that number continues to almost be non-existent, and it's not been very clear how we're going to address those disparities across the state of Minnesota going forward. So we would look forward to a discussion that would also include those issues as we go forward. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Farr. For the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sewell with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And just out of disclosure, because it's from the early conversations, Madam Chair, I am a lifelong resident of Northeast Minneapolis, but my family ancestry can be traced if you step out of the Vesa Lutheran Church, walk down the hillside towards the old elementary school, you'll find where my background comes from. So.
Oh.
The township issue on property tax is one that I think helps really frame the discussion we're trying to have, because if you look at property taxes in townships since the year 2000, they have doubled. Our local tax levies have doubled, and they are on pace right now. If we go up with our current percentage increases per year, in the 15 years from 1995 to 2010, they'll have tripled. That is largely due to two things: the loss of state aid that was completely eliminated from townships in 2000, and the escalating cost of road maintenance. As you're aware, we're responsible for over 50% of the roads in the state. The cost of maintaining those roads has skyrocketed. That said, if we eliminate property taxes without a very good and dependable replacement, you're going to have a lot of really bad roads out there, despite the wonderful transportation package that was passed earlier this session, because the local property tax, the township level, is still carrying the bulk of the weight for those local roads. As has been stated by Representative Villaforce and Representative Yarrows, one of the problems that we see at the township level is the fact that people are considered bland wealthy, but their incomes don't keep pace, and therefore you may be sitting on land that is worth a lot, but if you want to keep that land as open space or agricultural use, we need to find a way to keep those property taxes down, or more and more of those farmers and landholders are going to be forced to sell off, and we're going to have a real problem in the state with agricultural needs and open space preservation. And so while we're concerned about just saying we're eliminating property tax, it is a very worthy conversation to have because of the impact property taxes are having. And one last comment I will leave is that townships are unique in terms of local government. Hearing Ms. Schwab talk about their voter levies referendums, townships too, no property tax is imposed without the voters' approval at the annual meeting, which does help keep things down, because obviously if you've ever met a town officer, you know they are quite frugal. But that said, they still have had to double their levies over the last 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Thorne. Asa Township officials are also on Asa Church Council, so I do know how frugal they are. Representative Buford.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Shulam, obviously townships are reliant on the property tax right now, but your testimony from just a moment ago about transportation, I think, again begs the question we're having. Do you rely significantly on property taxes for transportation infrastructure? And I think that's the question you ought to have, is that fair? And it's one of the reasons why I authored the bill, in a sense, because there's not a strong nexus necessarily between your property and how much it's worth and how much you use the transportation system. So it's an excellent illustration. But even more than that, it's really the school. For me, that's the nub of this issue, because unlike everything else, there's nothing in the Minnesota Constitution that says cities shall do this, they shall do that, and the same with counties. They're strictly a creation of the legislature, and we do what we will. But the Minnesota Constitution says we're going to have a uniform system of public education, and to me that's an incredibly large distinction between townships, cities, and the school districts. And of course, it's a fundamental question about what that means precisely, but it wasn't put in there for the heck of it. We know the framers wrote things into our Constitution for very important reasons, and the system of uniform education is really important to me, and I find that perhaps that is where things are most unfair. And I understand school districts want to hang on to levies because you feel more and more, and I understand this, that you're using them to fund what you consider to be necessities as opposed to excess levies having the philosophical underpinning, you know, the time ago that they were for extras, so to speak. But even then, it begs the question about, is it fair for one district to be able to have all these extras and another not? And so I think for me, this really is the number of the issue. And I'll tell you what I really find unfair about it, and I have a lot of sympathy for the school boards, is in the Anoka-Hennepin district where I live, and where 80% of the district I represent resides, we had a property tax levy in 2002, that we had an excess operating levy that was fairly successful. It was multi-tiered, but the important stuff passed. But the school board told me that the federal government simply would meet its fundamental obligation with respect to special ed. There would have been no need for a levy. And then we move on to the 2007 Anoka-Hennepin levy, and it's the same thing. In other words, like in every school district, and I don't know if you have aggregate numbers, there is a significant and growing gap between what we tell school districts to do and the money we give them with which to do it. And that's townships and then cities face the same thing. But it's incredibly different for schools, I think, because of the constitutional mandate that we have. And more than that, you have to go out to the voters. And I really have a lot of sympathy with these poor school board members go to these public meetings to try and pitch a levy, and they get the tar kicked out of them by a lot of residents, especially, hey, we gave $800 million to public education. Why are you coming back at us? And so these school board members, in many respects, get left holding the bag and trying to raise revenues for mandates that somebody else laid on them. And it is, again, consistent with my bill, but I think out of anybody, we ought not to have school districts author excess levies, because I think in many respects it skews our commitment to a uniform system of public education, and I think that it's patently unfair, just like it is for other local jurisdictions, but these school boards go out to try and pitch a levy, and so often it's to cover the gap in the mandates that especially the federal government and also the state has laid on them.
Thank you for that. Thank you. All right.
Hello, my name is Steve Peterson with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Wasn't sure if I was going to testify today, but you know, we're going to have a nice tax policy discussion. I can't help myself. The Coalition, of course, we don't have a position on your bill, Representative Buford. But if we go take that to that next step, there's a lot of things that you have to talk about as the replacement of the actual property tax. And the most obvious one that's done in a lot of states is the sales tax. And if we just were to go to the full extent and remove the property tax, I think a great example that we're all at least abstract familiar with is Lake Minnetonka. And if you think about it, Excelsior, which is probably the property poorest city around Lake Minnetonka, if we did sales tax, all of a sudden would be the richest city in Tonka Bay, which is one of the richest cities, would be one of the poorest cities because they have no sales tax base. And the reason I bring that up is if we were to go away from a property tax into a sales tax, is the competition for retail in your city would go through the roof. And that's one of those things that with just the disparities in the metro area, I know I'm talking metro stuff right now, but come through background, that would accelerate. And if you took that into greater Minnesota and you go up on Grange, where Babbitt does not have any retail, and it's in Ely or in Hibbing or Virginia, you'd have the same dilemma of how do we balance the sales tax portion of it. If you did income tax, of course, then you'd have to have the ultimate in equalization, which, as the coalition, I have to say, one of our biggest factors is we always believe that a city should be able to offer safe communities and good and quality services at a same tax rate, property tax rate. And if we went to a straight income tax, we'd do that, but you'd also lose some ability of local control unless you had localized income tax, which I would not want to be the person who has to administer that. So that said, I think bringing this up is a valid idea of talking about it. There's, of course, the idea of modifying the third leg of the stool, the property tax, making it a way that's a little less on valuation, put it on to, I mean, Representative Prinke always talked about he wanted to measure his house and that's how much he'd pay. Well, you could do that, but I think some farm communities and some greater Minnesota communities would also have an issue with that if you did it on land size as opposed to valuation. And plus, it is a tax on wealth. And when you tax wealth, there has to be some way to catch that capital gain, otherwise the investment in metro area houses versus greater Minnesota houses would be completely different, where in greater Minnesota, if you buy a house for, you know, $45,000 today, it will probably be worth $55,000 10 years from now if you're lucky. I also want to say, because and I figured this is the opportunity, because I never get the opportunity to say this, I'm going to take off my coalition hat for a moment and put on my 30-year-old hat. As we talk a lot about protecting the seniors who are in a fixed income, I have to say that we also have to be careful of a whole generation of people who have purchased homes in the last 5 years. I have a friend who just bought a home in South Minneapolis. It originally listed for $229,000. That was the woman that bought it there. He just bought it. It was listed for $180,000, and he bought it for $150,000. The other person who just bought that house 2 years ago is down $80,000. We don't have equity. And I think we have to look at that when you talk about wealth in property taxes. It is a tax on wealth. And I understand that there are seniors who have, you don't want to push them out of your home, but we also have to look at, there is equity there. And how do we do that? If we get rid of the property tax system, we need to have some way to gauge that equity either on a sale of a capital gains. I'm talking totally abstract now, so everything I say is
okay.
Not the position of the coalition or anything like that.
And goals today, right?
Yeah. So I'm just putting that out there that we have to look at this from the, you know, and I, when I look around the room, I rarely see the 25 or 28-year-old new homeowner being representative as a child who has to put shoes on that kid and also pay property taxes. So when we look at income-based things for seniors, I think we have to be careful that we also look at the other end of the spectrum of the good home buyers. So that is my 30-year-old something comment.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I just want to make a few comments on where things are at with regards to the property taxes, specifically with regards to counties, and conclude with a reality check and an alternative suggestion to the Delaforest bill. First, I think, as you already know, the property tax is widely relied on for financing local governments. What perhaps gets lost in the discussion is that the level of government that is the largest levier of the property tax is counties, not cities, not school districts, but counties. We are very reliant on the property tax. It is our largest revenue source, and with the state of the state and, frankly, federal government's finances over the last several years, it's the increasing source of our revenues, having gone from about 36% of our revenues to 40% of our revenues between 2002 and 2005. During that same period of time, we've seen our state grants or aids fall from 46% of our overall revenues to less than 42%. Consequently, we have great concern about anything that suggests an alternative where we would have to rely on the state, because frankly, the state's proven itself to be an unreliable funder of us, as well as I think many local governments can make the same. The result has been that our property taxes have gone up, while our overall revenues have gone down on an inflation-adjusted basis. With regards to what happens if the property tax goes away, again, I think you need a reality check here. The property tax is the second largest source of revenue of state and local taxes in Minnesota. The only thing that eclipses that is the individual income tax. The sales tax is less. Corporate taxes don't even come close. So if you really mean to eliminate the tax, where are you going to come up with the revenue to replace that? I would frankly suggest, rather than spending time debating the fate of the property tax, that you simply fund the system as it's intended to have worked since its most recent gestation following the 2001 reforms. And that simply hasn't happened. Within a matter of a couple of years, the state simply has not been meeting its obligation to fund 100% of the school costs. With regard to the counties, it even goes farther back than that. You supposedly took over the funding of the health and income maintenance benefits back in the early 1990s. Beginning 2003, you once again asked the counties and effectively the property taxpayers to begin to pay those costs. Once again, with regard to the state's prisoners, for the first time, probably since the state's creation, you're asking the counties and again the property taxpayers to pick up a portion of the tab to house the state's prisoners, which have always been a state responsibility. Again, I think the focus needs to be on meeting your obligations under the current system, not looking at an overall blow-up implosion of the existing system. Final thing I would commend to you is homeowners are a special issue, and frankly, I think the committee was on the right track last year when they were focusing on homeowner-specific relief through the property tax refund program. Frankly, the system is too big to be an expense of dealing with general property tax relief, just as beyond the abilities of the current system to pay. You're not meeting your obligations for any of the aid programs to local governments. So to the extent we have a problem, it's largely one of homeowners to some degree for agricultural and selected other properties. But look to the most efficient, effective system to do that, and that's the property tax refund. With that, I'll conclude my comments and be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Any questions, members? Welcome for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Representative Dave LaForest, do you really know how to go out with a bang? Many of these comments have already been made, so I'm not going to repeat a lot of it. I think it's an interesting discussion to have. As somebody else mentioned earlier, we've been arguing about property taxes since, you know, before Joel Michael actually worked here, if that's possible. Somebody mentioned the Latimer Tax Study Commission, which was back in the mid-80s. They made some recommendations on how to improve the property tax, and the legislature actually did do some of those changes. And the business community did support some of those changes, and as we all know, back in the late 90s, the class rates were compressed. The class rates on business property were reduced. In 2001, there was further reform. We supported that reform. We still think that reform was a good idea. One of the reasons that reform was done, which isn't talked about very often, is frankly, to increase the accountability of the local property tax. So those people that were voting for the property tax increases, the people that were getting the services, were going to pay for more of those services. But even with that reform, as was mentioned earlier by Kay Rackow, business property is still paying three times more than homestead property. We have about a 12% share of the market value, but we pay about 30% of the overall property tax. So the disparity still exists. Ideally, we would like to get to a point where that disparity is reduced even more. Ideally, we'd like to get to a point where we don't have a classification system. Property is taxed based on its market value. And I guess we probably have more questions than answers about this particular bill. Many of them have been raised in terms of what would you replace it with, and what would be an appropriate revenue source to replace it with, and how would you equalize that revenue source? We would have to have maybe another super LGA type program to equalize, by whether it be an income tax or a sales tax. And as was mentioned earlier, the property tax is a relatively stable and reliable source of revenue, and there is some accountability between being taxed at the local level and the services you get, and we would want to make sure that that accountability stayed in whatever new system was developed. So there is some incentive for people to look at the services they're getting and be satisfied that what they're getting, what they're paying for. The last thing I would say is that on school funding, I know that is a big issue, and there is a lot of concern about school levy referendums. I know that even, you know, after we did the big 2001 reform and there was a substantial amount of property tax relief, many school districts did levy back some of that because they kind of had that cushion. And now we're kind of getting back to where we were, and I'm not sure that if we moved to sales tax or income tax that we would really address that problem with different school districts being able to raise more money than others. We'd have to have the same issue if we had a sales tax. You know, and Edina can probably raise more money at the sales tax than some other city. So I think whatever tax we have, I think the mayor of Minnetonka mentioned this, there is no perfect tax. And there'd be a lot of work that would need to be done, but it would be work that I think we'd be interested in participating in. I know the Budget Trends Commission is working on this very issue in conjunction with other taxes, and we look forward to looking what they come up with. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Mr. Michael. Back in 2001, I think I've heard the number of, we've been talking about the education expense here, I think the tax was about, on local level, was about 36-37%, and now I'm hearing that it's getting very close to that. Is that factual, or am I just imagining that?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, I'm not sure which percent you're referring to. The local
amount of input.
So what the local property tax is relative
to the school?
Yeah, to the school. Yeah.
To the school. I don't have that number off the top, but I can go get that for you.
Thank you.
All right. For the record.
For the record, thank you, Madam
Big
Chair.
Name.
My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'll keep my comments brief since they've already been spoken by several of the previous testifiers. According to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association data, businesses already pay high property taxes, and we believe that businesses could use relief too. However, with this bill, we're concerned with how revenue would be replaced and if the business community would actually be better off under this proposal. Businesses do pay a disproportionate share of property taxes, as Ms. Larson just mentioned. In fact, as she said, commercial industrial property constitutes 12% of the taxable market value in the state that pays 30% of the total property taxes. And this doesn't even include the state general levy, which Ms. Rockow talked about earlier. Eliminating property taxes will create a hole in the general budget, and that will generate concern among our members of how that will be replaced. At the local level, elimination of property tax would be a much bigger issue for our members. For instance, if it was replaced with a local sales tax, businesses pay about 45% of the sales tax in the state versus paying the current 30% in property taxes right now. That would probably cause some concern amongst different members, as well as an option for a local income tax increase that would probably pit a lot of our small business members against large business members because, as you know, the S-Corps, LLCs, partnerships, a lot of them flow their business income through their personal income tax returns, and that's definitely different than what would happen with the larger businesses that are C corporations. So, just in conclusion, we're concerned about where the money would come from to replace this, but we are thankful for the opportunity to comment on this and look forward to more discussion.
Representative Beetleborg.
Madam Chair, Mr. Diedrich, so the devil you know right now is a lot better than the one you don't. I can understand that. But I actually have a comment for the Chair. Representative Lincheski, you know that this raises a related issue that I think is important to wrestle with going forward. These are just input costs. Whether it's property tax or sales tax or income tax, ultimately in some form, and it depends upon your business, but you try and pass it on to the consumer as much as possible. So whether it's a reduction in C&I taxes or the corporate tax rate, et cetera, ultimately to institute any of those reforms redounds to the benefit of the consumer, because so often these costs just get passed on to them anyway. And it's not the same issue, it's related, but I know you've been thinking about that, but it's another issue to wrestle with in an increasingly global economy and remaining competitive. As you know, we just these are input costs that you often just get passed on to the folks who are already paying property taxes on the personal residences.
Representative Lincoln.
Yeah, I agree with the statement.
And, okay.
Ma'am. It's all paid
for
someone, yeah.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against?
Well, I'll talk down.
All right. With that, we will lay it over for possible inclusion in the...
Madam Chair, I had one comment. The author of House File 3632, the former version, Representative Lincheski, guessed correctly. Would anybody else like to guess who authored the bill originally? Anybody have a guess?
Thank you.
Phil Krenke, it was. It was Representative Krenke. He originally authored the bill. And Madam Chair, again, thank you.
All right. We have one item of business left. Representative Demmer, would you like to move the minutes of April 7th and Tuesday, April 8th?
So moved.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Meeting adjourned.